He comes to us from the One Breath at a Time group, and I believe it's from the Shemhala meeting room or meeting place there in Decatur, Georgia. Please give a good hand to David N.
Hi, y'all. I'm David, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm supposed to get up here and tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and do the whole deal thing. So, when I'm up here from the Modium, I'm supposed to, kind of give my disclaimers. I don't speak for AA. I, do yada, yada, yada. My sobriety date is November 18th of 1985, and my home group is the One Breath at a Time meditation meeting at the Shambhala Meditation Center in Decatur, and my sponsor is Kirk W. So check. Okay, cool. So got all that preliminary stuff out of the way. What it was like. And I drank a lot and got locked up in treatment and came to AA, and so my life is better. Okay, thanks. How can I say that I was an alcoholic? I was freaking 15 years old, and my parents locked me up in rehab. So I was like, okay, great. This is like not really cool. I mean, it was the 80s, so your parents kind of put you in braces, and then they put you in drug rehab. That was kind of what was trendy then. And I don't know. I mean, I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew nothing about recovery. I knew nothing about any of this stuff. And I was, forced to sit in rooms like this. I went to a treatment center that, had a nice view of a ridge, and over in Cobb County, and they shoved me in a white van, and I kind of thought I was a criminal, and drugged me over to places like this, and like Napa, and Triangle, and other places. And I really thought my life was over. I really believed that this was it. This was that I was going to spend the rest of my life, stuck in rooms like this, hung around with old people, and I was. The first time that I took a drink, I didn't really think anything about it. I was 12 years old, and I was house sitting for my next door neighbor, and I opened up his liquor cabinet. I was in his kitchen, feeding his dogs, and so I was liquor cabinet. My parents didn't drink. I didn't have that kind of experience. My mom and dad, my grandfather was an alcoholic, so my mom is a black belt Al-Anon, so there wasn't any alcohol in our house. So I looked at his medicine cabinet, and I saw this bottle. It was, it looked different than all the others. It was square, and all the others seemed round and kind of oval-shaped. And it had a black label on it. All the others kind of were pastel. It was written with a black label with white writing. And it stood out. It seemed like it didn't belong. And that was exactly the way I felt. And so, I don't know, I just decided what the... this is being recorded, so I'll try not to... I opened it up and took the biggest drink that I possibly could, just to see what happens. And it hit the back of my throat and went all the way down to my belly. And I went, I thought I had drank poison. I didn't know what was happening. But about 10, 15 seconds after that experience, this amazing thing happened. All of the crap that I had thought about, all the worries that I had had, all of the, everything that, with all the concerns that I had about, you know, what I was going to do and pass algebra, everything that that was going on in my life disappeared. And suddenly all those voices in my head and all those things that, you know, the kind of the radio station in my head that's stuck in between two stations, you know, the static and all that kind of stuff stopped. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I can't say that at that moment I became an alcoholic. I don't know. I mean, that was my very first sip of alcohol. But I can tell you that the thought that went through my head after those 15 seconds and that burn down my throat was eureka. This is it. This is the thing that I need for the rest of my life. And so from that point forward, at 12 years old, I thought, how can I do this for the rest of my life? I don't know. You know, I don't know if... Some people talk about, you know, being born an alcoholic. Some people talk about, you know, crossing a wall and all that kind of other crap. Yeah, I have no idea anything like that. I have no idea about what it's like to try to control and manage my drinking, because I never did. From that point forward, I wanted to drink as much as I could, as often as I could. I mean, having one or two drinks, that was freaking alcohol abuse, in my opinion. I mean, why waste your time? I don't know. I don't get it. I don't think that way. You know, I've got a great example. I had double digit sobriety at this time, and you know, I'm thinking, okay, it's cool, I can have a party. You know, so my roommate and I, you know, we get together, we have this party, and you know, alcohol is served. I mean, it's, you know, a mixed crowd, some of my friends from AA, some of his, and you know, we're having a great time, and you know, it's about, oh, I don't know, 2 a.m. and we're cleaning up a little bit. And I walk into the kitchen, and he's got these two bottles of vodka, you know, these 2 gallon bottles of vodka. They just had, oh, just a shot left in the bottom. Just a shot. And so I walk into the kitchen, and he's like this, pouring them out over the sink. And I shriek. I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm cleaning up. And suddenly I realized in that moment, you know, I don't think like him. You know, I don't think like people who are non-alcoholic. You know, I mean, please, that much left in the vodka? We'd be doing a shot. I mean, for him, alcohol is like milk. You know, it's kind of good with cookies. You know, but he can kind of take it or leave it. You know, milk goes bad, he pours it down the sink. You know, there's a little bit left in the carton, You know, but not for me. I have this relationship with alcohol that I shriek when I see it being poured down the sink. I don't know. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I carried on with my day, and, you know, went. My dad ended up coming and finding me at my neighbor's house and taking me back home. And, well, that started the relationship with my parents, that I started seeing them as the problem. You know, because my parents didn't really want me to go over to my next-door neighbor's house anymore, and they certainly didn't want me raiding his liquor cabinet. And then, you know, I started finding some friends at school. You know, people often ask me, you know, why, how did you get drunk at, you know, 13 and 14? I mean, well, I probably don't have to tell some people in this crowd, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, how did I get liquor? How did I get, let me just say that my liquor came in other forms. It came in leaf form, and it came in pill form, and it came in other forms. And so, you know, how did I get these things? I went to school. That's what happened. And, you know, I was able to connect with some really cool people that were able to get me connected to lots of stuff. And all I had to do was, like, wear the cool outfits and wear the leather. And, I mean, this was the 80s. So it was all about, you know, Iron Maiden and Megadeth and, you know, Judas Priest. I mean, that was right on. I'm there with you, brother. I mean, that's what it was about. And so, you know, I wore my, you know, ripped up Iron Maiden t-shirts, and suddenly I had cool friends that were willing to give me lots of stuff, and it was not a problem. And so, you know, that went on for a while, and, you know, finally my parents locked me up in one rehab after I had tried to kill myself once. And, you know, then I got out, and I you know, told the View with the Ridge that I was going to do everything that I needed to do to stay sober, and, you know, did my 90 and 90 and got a sponsor, never called him, you know, went and hung out in meetings but didn't really go in, you know, because my friends were out smoking cigarettes and doing donuts in the parking lot, and, you know, why come into a meeting? And so, I don't know, you know, I stayed sober for a while because my dad told me that if I stayed sober, if I got a year sober, that he would get me a car. Rockin'. So, you know, the promises had come true. I got a car. You know, I got a car, I got a girlfriend, I was passing grades, you know, I was passing algebra, barely. But, you know, I mean, the promises had come true in my life, so why stick around AA? And so I went and I got drunk. And, you know, I stopped by Walgreens and got me a big old family-sized bottle of Robitussin. And, you know, I came home you know, my mom, having her black belt in Al-Anon, you know, told me that I wasn't welcome here. And so I left. And, you know, I called up a friend of mine. You know, of course, it's like, you know, within 24 hours after drinking, you know, one would think, okay, 24 hours after doing something, your life goes to crap. Maybe that one thing that I'm doing is not the thing to be doing, and I should stop it. No, you know, my thing is that, oh, the world needs to change, and you guys are all assholes, and, you know, blah, and I'm leaving, and I'm going to go live on the streets of Roswell. Yeah. You know, I'm going to go be a gutter punk kid in Roswell, Georgia. You know, there wasn't much of a scene back then, and so, yeah, it wasn't really working for me, but I called a friend of mine and I said, listen, you know, this is what's happened. I'm getting kicked out of my house. You know, my evil parents are throwing me out and I have nowhere to go. And yeah, dude, come on, you know. You know, he picked me up and we hitchhiked to his girlfriend's house over in Marietta. And, you know, I was so drunk at the time that his girlfriend's mom wouldn't let me in. Of course, you know, as any good friend did, he went on in to, you know, stay with his girlfriend, and I was left outside in the cold. And it was November, and so, you know, I pulled up couch right there in my best friend's girlfriend's mom's house backyard, and went to sleep on the lawn chair. You know, I woke up the next morning and I had fallen out of the lawn chair, and you know, I had really long hair, you know, poison, rocking. And you know, I the dew had kind of like matted my hair down, and there were some leaves stuck in it, and I remember just waking up with the morning sunshine, cold. And the very first thought that goes through my head was, where was the bottle? You know, not, am I okay? Not, what am I going to do? Not, how am I going to get out of this? My very first thought when I woke up was, you know, how am I going to get high? You know, and that was the time that I thought that maybe, just maybe, the folks in AA might have something to say. Just maybe there is a possibility, and I'm not saying, just maybe a slight possibility that I had gotten it a little wrong. That maybe all the people in AA and my parents and my teachers and all the people around me who I thought were the problem, and if you had my family and you'd be drinking too, you know, all that. Just maybe I had it a little backwards. That you weren't the problem. Maybe you were the solution and alcohol was my problem. You know, I had viewed alcohol as my solution for so long. Why drink? You know, because I have to deal with you, and I have to deal with these feelings, and I have to deal with all this crap. Maybe I had it just a little wrong. Well, I won't say that I went to a meeting at that. You know, of course, I went and found the bottle and went and, you know, got drunk. You know, eventually, my dad picked me up hitchhiking and wanted to know, of course, why I had 5 family-sized bottles of Robitussin in my backpack. I don't know, because I might get sick, you know. But I was willing to be honest with them a little bit, and, you know, my parents put me back in treatment. And so this was the third time that I went in treatment. You know, I actually started listening in AA, and then I started seeing this word called God, and that was a really uncomfortable word. You know, I didn't like that word. Still don't really like that word. You know, they talk about in the literature how it kind of bristle. You know, people will talk about that word. I'm that guy. You know, I still don't really like it. And so, I don't know, people were like, oh, well, you know, Christian this and blah, 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 and just fine. And, somebody said, well, you know, find your own God. And I was like, okay, fine, I'll do that. And so I started thinking about, all right, what could be a cool God? I don't know. And I started thinking, all right, what's kind of like the coolest thing that I can think of? What's something that's like really that I think, you know, that I really want to do and I really want to be? Yeah, that's it. David Lee Roth. Hell yeah, dude. I mean, David Lee Roth had everything, man. I mean, he had the cool hair. I mean, he had the girls. He had, you know, I mean, Van Halen. I mean, they're a rock god. I mean, who wouldn't? David Lee Roth. There he is. So, you know, I mean, and of course I was like, you know, saying out to my sponsor, yeah, dude, I'm going to get David Lee Roth as my higher power. And my sponsor, and I was expecting to spite, you know, that you can't do that. He was like, okay. I was like, really? What would David Lee Roth say? And that's all that it says in the book. All it says in the book is just having a willingness to believe in anything. You know, something that's going to be able to help you. You know, I don't know. I mean, I progressed on through the steps, and, you know, when it came time to, you know, looking for a power that I could believe in, I started looking at my home group, and I started looking at my sponsor, and I started looking at the people who really had my best interest in mind. And yeah, David Lee Roth was cool, and, you know, he got me to that next meeting. But, you know, my home group and the people, my sponsor and the people who are around me, those are the people that started showing me some good orderly direction. You know, I don't know. I kind of stuck around for a while, and thank God graduated high school. That was hard. But, you know, then I started thinking, okay, what do I do now? You know, I don't know. I had a couple of years sober and didn't know what the hell to do. I cussed. So, I don't know. You know, I started writing, doing my 4-step and trying to figure out who I am. And, about this time I went to a conference. I was hanging out with some folks, and they drugged me to New York back in the early 90s. And I went to this thing called ICIPA, which is the International Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. And it happened to be in Manhattan. It was in New York. And I thought, Yeah. AA conference. Yay. Yay. You know, but I walked in that room and I walked into the dance. You know, I mean, I had been around. I mean, okay, AA dances. You know, how many times can you hear Wham and, you know, freaking, you know, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, whatever. You know, I was over it. And I walked into the dance after the meeting at Ikipa, and I thought it was going to be this lame, like it usually is. And it wasn't. It was this amazing rave that was happening, and I was the floor of the hotel was bouncing up and down. This is the truth. The chandelier below the banquet room was falling because of the excitement of this party, and I was completely blown away. And I thought to myself, you know, sobriety isn't this bad. And all these people were sober. It was thousands of people in this room having a blast, and all these people were sober. And I don't know, you know, I came back and it really re-energized me. And I came back and I was, you know, I got involved in Gikipa and was able to go and get enrolled in college and started college at Kennesaw State and started doing some stuff like that. And it was just amazing, you know, that I really was able to find my place in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at this lame-ass crap that I thought was AA, you know, that I was going to be destined to be boring and glum, was absolutely wrong. You know, because I thought, when I was drinking, I never really left Roswell. I never really did anything. I never went anywhere. You know, and here I was given an opportunity. I went to New York. I went all over these places. You know, I don't know, you know, I went out to, I moved out to California. I went to graduate school in California. And, you know, I don't know, what else do you do but keep going to school? I don't know, I mean, after I graduated California, I started figuring, you know, like, you know, AA is kind of getting lame and old. You know, all right, I got sober when Madonna was a virgin. You know, this is kind of lame now. And I want to kind of move on. I mean, you know, how can I be an alcoholic? I was just a kid. I'm grown now. Y'all, see, you don't understand me. And so I was kind of getting really disheartened with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was really not finding my God of my understanding, and I lost contact with him. And so, I don't know, I was feeling a bit lost. And, you know, I was going to move back to Atlanta, and so I decided before I moved back to Atlanta, I was going to do this great hurrah, and I decided to go backpacking in Australia for a while. And I got into Sydney, and I flew into Sydney, and nobody knew me there. Nobody knew what was going on. No, I was not accountable to anybody. I don't know. There was lots of bars in Sydney. Foster's. Hey. And so, I don't know. You know, of course, you know, I had this head full of AA, and, you know, my addiction was also talking in my head. And you know, the head full of AA said, you know what, just call central office and see what's up. Okay, fine. I'll call. If there's a meeting convenient to me, I may go. Hey, central office, what up? I'm in from the States. Is there a meeting? Yeah, there's a meeting. Okay. Well, is there a young people's meeting? Yeah? Oh. Okay, what? You're putting me on hold? All right. Why, there's a young people's conference called NUIPA? What's that? The New South Wales Young People's Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous? Oh, that's kind of cool. When's that? It starts tomorrow? Really? Where? You mean the hotel that's right next door to me? Okay, God. I get that one. I got that. And so I ended up going to Nuipah in freaking Sydney, Australia. And it was absolutely amazing. I met people from... I met people from all over Australia, and they were like, dude, come stay with us. And I was like, okay. And so I was backpacked around Australia for 2 months, you know, freaking on, crashing on people's couches in AA and going to meetings all over. I don't know, and that's really what kind of came to a place of looking at the 11th step for me, you know, and looking at how I had that daily and conscious contact with God, because, you know, I let God slip away, and I didn't really give a about AA. I didn't give a thing about God, you know. I was just, you know, cruising along, you know, doing my stuff, and, you know, God slapped me upside the face and was like, you know, hey, you know, I'm still here. And so I don't know, you know, my home group is the One Breath at a Time, you know, 11th step meditation meeting. And I suck at it. That's why I go to meetings. And that's why I go to a meditation meeting, because I suck at meditation. You know, everybody's like, ooh, you must really be spiritual because you go to an 11th step meditation meeting. I'm like, no, dude, that's why I go to the meeting, is because I don't. You know? I mean, because it gives me an opportunity to have 10 minutes of sitting meditation, you know, during the meeting. And it's really cool for me. And it's really cool for me to be able to have that practice of being able to remind myself, you know, that God is still present in my life. And I think about that. I think about, you know, looking at the 12th step and working with others and things like that. You know, I've got a couple of sponsees, and I got a sponsee that he's a student at Emory, and I don't know. You know, he was bemoaning to me about, you know, oh, I can't find a summer job and blah blah blah, and, you know, all that kind of crap. You know, you listen to your sponsees and you're like, yeah, okay. And so I just happened to be like, oh yeah, dude, I'm going to prove you wrong. So I just happened to grab the AJC and happened to open it up to, you know, the want ads to be able to prove to him that there were summer jobs out there. And in the process, I just happened to glance down and saw this, you know, job for, you know, a really cool job. And I said, oh, that's kind of a cool job. I could do that. So I sent in my resume. And I don't know, a couple months later, they called me back. And they said, we'd like to interview you. And I said, cool. And so I interviewed. And then they said they'd like to hire me. I said, well, cool. I said, well, you know, I'm really happy with the job that I have now. Well, yeah, but what would it take to get you here? I said, this much. And they said, okay. Oh, damn, I should ask them more. I was like, so I had this amazingly cool job that I had no intentions of getting, nor was looking for, and the only reason that I was opening the AJC was to prove to my sponsee that there were summer jobs out there. So by kind of working with others, you know, by if I hadn't had a sponsee, if I hadn't have been working with somebody else, I would have never gotten this job. You know, I don't know, and that's the way God works in my life. You know, I mean, it's kind of cool that way. You know, I don't know. You know, people ask me, you know, dude, you got, like, you know, more time sober than I've been alive. You know, like, why do you still go to meetings? And my response to that is because that's where the newcomers are. You know, I don't know. I mean, if it's not for the folks that are in my life and the newcomers and the folks that are in my life, you know, I'll get this belief that you know, it's been so many years and, you know, I'm grown up. I'm mature now. I can handle it. You know, I just want to be normal. And I'll forget the fact that I was stuck in my friend's girlfriend's mom's backyard thinking about getting high. And I'll forget about that. And I'll forget about the the pain and the destitution that I saw when I looked across my mom, and you know, they were doing the intervention. And my mom looked across the room, and the doctor, kind of psychiatrist, looked at my mom and was like, "He doesn't know why he's here, does he?" And my mom just kind of shook her head no. And the therapist was like, "Well, you know, we want you to stay here for your own best interest." Yeah. But then my mom looked up at me, and she looked at me with this look of complete hopelessness. This complete hopelessness that my son is a drunk, my son's a drug addict, and he's never going to get it. I'll forget that. And I easily forget that. And, you know, by coming and talking to folks, and by coming and talking and speaking in a meeting, and by talking to newcomers and hanging around with people in the program, I won't forget that. Because you're able to help me remind that. You know, there's a guy that I was working with for a while, you know, that I won't say I had the pleasure of going to visit him in jail. But I got to go visit him in jail. And it immediately reminded me exactly what it was like when I was locked up. You know, that's why I do that. That's why, you know, I come here. You know, I can tell you that AA has been amazing for me, and through that process of coming to find a power greater than me. You know, there's a part in the book that I always like reading, and it comes out of A Vision for You. And on page 151, it says, you know, "For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. Ah. It is the joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. But not so with us. Those last days of heavy drinking, the old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past." You know, and that feeling that I got when I took my very first drink, you know, that burning sensation, that feeling of everything was going to be okay. You know, it says here on the next page on 152, "Yes, there is a substitute. It is vastly more than that, is the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. The very things that I was drinking for." You know, the interesting thing to me, I always like on the previous page, it talks about the reason I was drinking was for care, boredom, and worry. And here I'll find release from care, boredom, and worry. "Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus, you will find the fellowship, and so will you." That's certainly been my story. I don't know. I, there's still time to be able to find another meeting around if you might need one. I don't know. There may be a 10 o'clock down at Napa or down at Triangle. We can get you down there. You know. But I really want to thank you guys. I mean, and certainly thanks Tim for asking me to come and speak. You know, doing service is a lot like. I don't know. I mean, they always kind of talk about service and the joys of service. You know, to me, service is kind of like, I don't know, peeing in your pants. Well, you know, everybody sees it, but really only you feel the warmth. So, Tim, I thank you for inviting me to come and speak and being a part of your group. It certainly has been a pleasure. So thank you very much.
child. Things moved out of my way, running so fast and wild. There's nothing more you need inside.